This is a continuation of the hearing on Committee Substitute Senate Bill number 41. The motion I would like to entertain, we have not had the time to put into a draft or even a handwritten draft the amendments that are before you. I would like to have a motion that would suggest that the work draft is before us, which includes amendments that are now on your plate. Mr. Chairman, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt a new finance CS for sponsored substitute for Senate Bill 41, incorporating the amendments on the sheet labeled Work Draft 3491.
Without objection, it's so ordered. That will be printed up as soon as is physically possible. But we now know what we have before us is a work draft, and at this time, we'd ask the Department of Transportation. We have people from the Department of Transportation to come forward. There are several questions we would like to ask. The first question I'm going to ask Senator Hoffman. He had a question that involved emergencies in his area. And you have the floor, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an earlier version Senate Bill 41, the J version, there was an inclusion in Section 8 of $114,000 appropriated from the general fund to a DOT central region for the Bethel Airport lighting. And I'm aware of the problems at the airport, particularly in last fall when the lights went down for a number of weeks, and it necessitated reducing the flights from 5 days, five times a day to one time a day. And my question is it necessary for the to rectify the problem that early funding be included in the budget, or can the appropriation be made at a later time to address the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Ron Lamb from DOT. If I could just look at my notes here just a second on that.
Is there an urgency, in other words, immediately?
Mr. Chairman, the $114,000 we've identified had actually been for multiple airports in the Bethel area where we've been having problems with wiring separations in the conduit underground. Clearly, the nature of the climate and such out there is, and we're not going to fix those immediately until spring comes, so it could be delayed for some portion of time.
Thank you.
Not going to fix them until June, July.
Yes, sir.
My colleague from Took is missing it also in the same, the original budget. Section 9 had to do with Healy Canyon Rock Slide that did the horse repair. It also goes along with the memo that is dated February 5th, 1991. Our sense is this should be on a fast track. What is your opinion on that?
Mr. Chairman, the request for Healy Canyon, actuality, the Department, Interior District M&O, has spent about $500,000 out of the current M&O operations. And part of this money was to reimburse them for expenditures they've already made. They also feel they're going to have another considerable amount of expense this spring when it thaws. They expect to have continued mudslides in that area. We're going to necessarily do the repairs to make the road available for use. And if we didn't get the supplemental, we'd just continue to spend our regular maintenance money, and other things would need to be deferred on into the future.
So your opinion, is this money needed now, or is this, can you wait?
As I said, we've already spent about $500,000, so that reimbursement, if it doesn't come now, means we're going to continue to delay other work in the hopes that it eventually would come.
Now, the second part, the last one on that is the western region there. There's about $76,000 for non-maintenance, as you can see it. In section number 26 of this bill, there's $2.1 million, and it says for removal of snow and ice and repair of storm damage. Would this also include the village of Gamble, which is about $32,000 of erosion problems due to a storm damage, Diomede, and Deering?
I believe the original amount that we had in for snow and ice did not include the damages at Deering Gamble.
You know, DOT has had a position before OMB, and I really not know, you know, what it is, what you need. I resent you not having the deputy commissioner here, too, because you're in the middle. You know, you're trying to answer a question, but I don't know what the party line is here.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Durkin had been scheduled for another legislative meeting at 8:30 this morning.
As long as you can make policy decisions here and give us the effect. You have the floor, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the rock slide monies, and I think I understand what you're saying, that until there's some certainty whether that money will be made up, they'll either be spending a deficit situation or holding back on some more routine maintenance in the springtime. Every other year or so, I go for a little drive with our maintenance people in Anchorage, the Anchorage District Maintenance Office. That seems to be the situation every year for them. That they always run, there's either a big snow year, something happens, and they always are running into what normally would be their spring maintenance money or their deferred maintenance money. And typically, DOT does get a supplemental, typically in May, and somehow life goes on and we probably shortchange deferred maintenance. Is this a unique situation for that particular district?
The magnitude of the problem in Healy Canyon is certainly unique. They have the same problem right now with snow and ice that a supplemental request that other regions have. But just the magnitude of the problem in the Healy Canyon slide area, the long-term solution is probably going to be a federal project that's going to move the road. And there's PE work going on right now to look at that condition. Alaska Railroad has also spent a considerable sum on the other side of the river where they have sloughage. Basically, the hillside sloughing down.
It's a $100 million problem, is what I've been told. Cheryl, would you come up? Because I'm going to have somebody's hide pretty quick. It's not yours, you're not the gentleman in front of me. But now, OMB had these materials. What's the testimony of OMB to the questions that were posed by Senator Adams on behalf of Senator Schultz, who is up speaking right now with the governor?
Mr. Chairman, the request that we received from DOT in preparation of the supplemental from the administration was for snow and ice removal. I looked at the language in their memo that they sent to us, and they did not discuss storm damage. So that was a new purpose that was not requested of OMB.
So the snow and ice removal category for nearly $2 million, without looking, that's my memory, would include such extraordinary costs as the one that Healy Canyon now attests to a need for, is that right? Or did they never ask you about Healy Canyon?
Mr. Chairman, they did make a request for Healy Canyon in addition to the snow and ice. I mean, they were separate requests. We did not include the Healy Canyon in our request that we submitted to the legislature, asking instead that they reprioritize their projects and try to do
and that. Why didn't you? It's in the best beliefs of the communication between highways and yourself or your agency that it didn't need fast tracking? Is that the case?
Well, we knew that they had already spent amount of money on it, that we were reimbursing them, and that they would just need to reprioritize within their existing budget, plus the other M&O money that was included in for additional costs. So it was a matter of trying to make best with what they've got outside of new money and new projects.
You felt compared to other agencies, your overall budget allocations of Class 3 and so on, and the specialized in snow, and et cetera, gave them a fair bite of what funds would be available for governmental purposes. The fair section is what you allocated. Is that something in there?
I mean, we tried to meet a number of their extraordinary needs, and we just didn't have, we were trying to meet all the agency's extraordinary needs, and felt that DOT, we had made our best effort, and we did not fund all of their requests.
Okay, is the Senator Schultz concern, will that, in your opinion, take from the coming year's opportunity to fund items of greater priority, or is this one of the very highest priority items? In other words, there's a limited amount of funds that seems to be being reduced every day, and you didn't put into the supplemental the Healy Canyon, et cetera, and you gave us essentially the reasons. However, if we do fund this, is that the opinion of the administration, to the extent that you can speak for them, somebody's got to speak for them, that it'll take from some other area that's even more vital, because we have limited finances to do all these jobs. Will it take from the concerns of Senator Porchot or Senator Petula that are equally or more important to be attested to? I don't know. I think that's the reason we're here.
Mr. Chairman, we did not ask the department what other projects they would forego if we did not give them these additional dollars. So, but it's reasonable to think other needs would not get taken care of in this current fiscal year if we did not give them these additional dollars. So.
Are there questions of any participant here by the senator? You have the floor, Senator Hoffman.
Regarding the $2.1 million for snow and ice and repair of storm damage, do you have a breakdown of how much of that is for removal of snow and ice between the categories of airport snow removal and road snow removal?
No, Senator Hoffman, I don't have a breakdown of that type. I have just the breakdown by district or region, if you will.
Jeff Parson.
Maybe within that money you can swing back by the University of Fairbanks, as they're asking for $221 million for snow removal, and hit them at the same time, and then we can delete Section 34.
Well, I think we want to have Mr. Gerken to come up as soon as is possible to speak to us. So ask him to come up and be very aware of the concern of the senators in this regard, including the need to prioritize within limited funds. And I think you need to have that meeting today, in which Senator Hoffman, Senator Schultz, Senator Adams, and all the rest of us hopefully can attend. But bring him up here, or whoever else speaks. I'd like OMB here at the same time after you put this together, and you put it together for this afternoon sometime as quickly as possible, because we want to move this bill along. They have legitimate concerns out there, and we want to get to the bottom of it and see. And quite frankly, we're asking $70 million in this supplemental, and everything's an emergency, and we're beginning to worry that there isn't the income necessary to support too many of these types of supplemental. I guess there are questions about the University of Alaska. Is the University of Alaska, please sit here again, OMB. Is the University of Alaska's... there was a question by Senator Adams came up, and it had come up previously. So,
thank you.
And Ms. Redmond, I guess you should introduce yourself because we're on record. Wendy.
My name is Wendy Redmond. I'm Vice President for University Relations for the statewide system.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Adams in this case.
The justification of section number 34 of the bill in regards to $222,100 for snow removal. And basically, I thought at the same time, since we got section number 26, we'll have DOT just come sweep your road for you, just real fast. Just justification on that one.
I guess to the chair, Senator Adams, I think the justification, I hope those were distributed to each of the senators that came in with our request for the supplemental. Fairbanks this year, in what we hope was an anomaly, had almost 90 inches of snow in a 2-month period of time when the normal average is 12 inches of snow. As you may have heard, there have been over a dozen roofs in Fairbanks that were that fell in as a result of the snow. We do not have a base budget. We do not have money in the base budget for those kinds of anomalies. That's what this request is all about. It is not anticipated that we will need this need to build up our base permanently to handle this kind of snow removal. We hope it's a 1-year problem.
Mr. Chairman, the committee members from this committee is leaving for Fairbanks on Friday, and they can make a recommendation as there's either need machineries or shovels, and so I think there's a public hearing at the campus. Sir?
I'm not going to shovel.
Well, maybe the students can. But I would like to have this on hold. We're not moving the bill today. It's just until we have a report from a good senator from Juneau.
Maybe you could stop by my area with that shovel. I have something else to do with it. You have the floor, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we want to wait till, I don't know when you get back, Tuesday, Wednesday, next week?
We want to look at it. Depending on the Juneau Airport, or is it the Fairbanks Airport?
I don't know if we want to wait that long, but I think, Ms. Redmond can correct me, hopefully he won't run into snow. I mean, hopefully the trouble is it's already taken care of, I hope, and that you're just deficit spending in that category.
Yes, through the chair, that's correct. The snow is, at least it is off the roofs and off the streets. There are 8-10 foot high berms that are still around campus from the snow removal that are now being removed.
So he could work on the berms.
Yes, we could, yeah. We could get the
senator to work. Due to the exigencies of time and the desire to get some of these projects paid for, get road maintenance out, I hesitate to hold it very much longer. I think by tomorrow morning we should be acting on the bill. From the Senate side, that's my problem, but we'll undoubtedly have a motion of deletion there when we finally act on the bill from the sound of the table, I'd say. Are there any other questions the university will ask, at least at this moment? You have the floor, Senator.
The only thing that we had stated that with the University of Alaska, the marine system, if there's any other facilities that had a fuel increase cost, we also ask that same privilege in par cost equalization. I have been assured by my colleague from Anchorage that the increase of $495,000 is not needed at this time, that the supplemental amount of $1.9 million is sufficient to take care of par cost equalization. And so I'd like to put that on record. If we're going to do it through state facilities and ferry systems, that we need to at least have that on record, that perhaps in the future that this comes up, then I will be obligated to put a supplemental through for other facilities.
But, you know, it's not lost on us that there is Chukchi, Kuskokwim, Northwest also getting fuel support here.
That is correct.
Yes, Warren.
Just to clarify the record, I think that's right. That my understanding from a recent subcommittee meeting and talks with Director Laresh that the 400 so shortfall that was originally indicated that...
Mr. Rash, would you come forward and just grab a chair?
Actually, maybe Mr. Chairman, probably, I think Mr. Laresh could probably say the same thing better than I.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Laresh, the Executive Director of the Energy Authority this morning.
For another day, my friend.
I have been to my office, so I can make that statement with some assurance. Basically, we did the calculation, Senator Adams and Senator Borsho, based on the most recent fuel prices, which were at November and December 1990. Then we added a contingency of $224,000 just to be certain, because, of course, in this program, if there's a shortfall, the 66,000 consumers are directly hurt. It's not a matter of a state facility being hurt. So we added a $224,000 contingency. The governor approved a $1,979.6 supplemental. And by our calculations at that time, we would have been $494,000 short, which would have made it short in reimbursements to utilities for electricity sold in June. But as I discussed with Senator Porchot, that amount does include the $224,000 shortfall. It's also calculated against fuel prices when they were at their highest. We all know they've come down since then, although you've got to remember that these fuel purchases, many of them have already been made at the higher prices. So it's my guess, best guess personally, that we'll probably skate through without the 494. That's the most probable outcome. But there is a chance that we'll be a little short in June, in which case, of course, what we would do is we don't make those June payments until July or August. And we basically have a reverse carry forward from whatever funds we get next year. So I think it will work this way, although, of course, I can't guarantee it since it's based on temperatures and fuel prices.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that with that testimony, I would request that AEA give us a further update when we're discussing our regular supplemental to see what the financial status is at that time.
Yeah, it goes without saying. Would you write me a short note to the effect of your testimony, too?
Yes,
this will come up on the floor again. I'd like to have your conservative estimate, whatever you've stated here.
Good.
Thank you. Are there questions of any other area at this time? You have the floor, Senator Porchot.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify just a few things of what we did or what we didn't do. In our consideration of this bill, I think sometimes our original purpose is somewhat overlooked, in that the attempt here is to do an early supplemental of key items. And that's clearly with the understanding that there are other supplementals out there, many of which, if not all, have been identified in other pieces of legislation by the administration. And there will be other agencies and other programs that are going to run short that we will undoubtedly be addressing later in the session, including, I might add, the court system, which has had some problems getting through the OMB process. And I think we'll want to take another look at the court system independently. In addition, I wanted to say something about what was in our old finance bill, sections 8 and 9, the ARCA shelter and the Matsu Counseling Center. In the members' packet is a letter, I hope, from ARCA, the Association of Retarded Citizens for Alaska, for Anchorage, and it lays out real well the special circumstances concerning those two projects and their use of more than matching federal funds and their prior commitments and some of the special problems they've had. I think they make a good case for those two projects. However, I think, Mr. Chairman, it was probably wise to delete those from this bill, not because of their worthiness, but because they are capital projects. They were vetoed items last year, and there are a lot of other vetoed items that I'm sure members are interested in. And I think our deletion of that, I would like to hope that is not indicative of the merits of those projects, but rather the vehicle involved. And that it would be at least my personal intention that those two projects would be considered in the development of a capital budget. And there may be other similarly situated projects.
I think they're quite as important as many things we have today, even my valued and loved university, but they are capital related, so both you and I have immense concerns about it. But we're trying to symbolically let it be known that this is supplemental for operating and for emergency operating. I frankly could remove 50% of it without any problem in numbers, maybe not in dollars. Are there any other questions at this time? Allison, if it's possible, I'd like to see you at the end of this. I think we can recess this portion and turn the meeting over to Senator Porchot and his call.
We've got 9 o'clock.
And we'll be back as soon as possible.
Is this the correct time?
Yeah.
Why don't we reconvene
yes,
at 9 o'clock? I think we're going to set up some teleconference.
Thank you very much. We want all seven members. I don't know where Senator
started. We're going to try to take up several bills today, and we don't know whether we're going to get in trouble on them or not, or what the problems may be, but we're going to give it a stab. I would, pardon me, we do have people on teleconference for one or more of the bills here today. For those of you on teleconference, we have gotten started. First bill we're going to take up is SJR 6, relating to an amendment to the Constitution of the United States prohibiting desecration of the flag of the United States. Is the bill sponsor here, Senator Zaroff? Is there anyone from Senator Zaroff's office? I think we do have a couple of people standing by on testimony, which I don't have in front of me here. I know there was... is there someone from, representing the American Legion desiring to testify on this bill? Mr. Culber, would you please proceed? Mr. Culber, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Please proceed. Well, if you could proceed, we will get started here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Evans, the American Legion support the burning of the flag. The flag, as far as our position is concerned, the President of the United States, which is a memorial and a resolution to the Congress, authorizes, of course, the state on behalf of, you know, its members to... okay, with the amendment, which would authorize the Congress
Trevor, thank you for your testimony. We do have the bill sponsor, Senator Zaroff. Senator Zaroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the hearing of the Senate Joint Resolution 6, and I'm sorry you got here a little bit late, but basically all this resolution does is it requests Congress of the United States to propose an amendment to the Constitution of the United States that would prohibit the physical desecration of the U.S. flag, or, in the alternative, request the Congress to call a convention for the sole purpose of proposing to the states an amendment to the Constitution of the United States prohibiting the desecration of the flag. Thank you. And in 1989, Congress passed a law prohibiting the flag desecration, but last summer, the Supreme Court ruled the law unconstitutional. And so in the minds of many, this has been made more apparent that the only way to prohibit the desecration of the United States flag is to do it through a constitutional amendment. And the issue of the constitutional amendment has been previously before the U.S. Congress, and it did require or secure a majority of votes in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, but it did not reach the required two-thirds that were necessary. The American Legion, I think the poll that was conducted by them, I think is in your packet, it was conducted last spring, indicated that over 70% of those questioned felt that desecration of the U.S. flag should not be protected under the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment, and that they wouldn't support a narrowly written constitutional amendment prohibiting flag desecration. Mr. Chairman, I guess I could try to answer any questions that you might have, but as I said here, it does not in any way bind anybody. This is just a sense of the feeling of the state, and I didn't want to get into the emotional emotions that surround the issue, and I'm sure that there are arguments on both sides of the issue, and it's going to be basically a judgment call by each individual and how they feel one way or the other. And I also might add that there have been at least two amendments that I know of that were proposed for your consideration. And I only see one amendment here in my packet, they're both here. One is from Senator Hoffman, which wishes to include a whereas clause that identifies the 49th state as part of the 50 states and part of the U.S. flag. I don't have any problems with that. I think it's a good amendment. And then also, senators, there were a couple other senators, at least one other senator that proposed and I would include a resolve clause that would basically state that the U.S. flag could be exhibited or displayed as a symbol of support for the freedoms, values, and rights expressed by the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And I guess this sort of stemmed from the concerns that sort of came up sporadically throughout the country where people were not being allowed to display the flag to show their support of activities in the Middle East. And one incident that I have heard about that I'm probably more familiar, and I'm sure that there are other isolated instances elsewhere, but I believe this was a condominium complex in Florida where one condominium owner or housing owner, whatever it was, wished to display a flag for her support of what was going on, and I think it may have been a family member. And the association bylaws stated there that they could only display flags on holidays. They since, from what I understand, have backed off from that position. And I think this amendment is saying basically the same thing. As long as you want, you can display the flag, as long as you do it in a in a patriotic manner there, and you won't be prohibited from doing so.
Senator Zaroff, I think one of the questions that we're going to hear some legal people speak to is this whole question on whether or not this indeed is a sense of the Senate resolution, or whether or not this is the formalized petition process by the state of Alaska as one of potential two-thirds of the states calling for a constitutional convention. And I was a little bit puzzled or confused by your testimony on what your desires were. And I think what we'll hear is concerning the word memorial on page 3, line 2, which has a legal definition that could, and I think in your packets is a copy of the U.S. Constitution amendment process with a definition of memorial on, and as you stated, you can amend the U.S. Constitution by two manners, one two-thirds vote of either body in Congress, or an application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, in which time a constitutional convention would be called to may or may not just limit itself to this particular amendment. The use of the word memorial might indicate that this is the state of Alaska's formal petition calling for a constitutional convention, not just as we commonly know as a sense of the Senate urging the Congress to do something. What's your intention of this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to get into the realm of legalities on this thing, and I'm not going to get into the technicalities of what various words mean. We're all aware that a comma and a period and the word the or shall or may have different meanings to different people, and I guess I'll leave this up to the legal beagles, but my sense of this here, this being a Senate joint resolution, would require action by the House as well. And if adopted or passed, would also require the governor's signature. So it would therefore be a sense of the state of Alaska. If it were a simple Senate resolution, it would be just an SR6 rather than an SJR.
All right. Senator Kurtula.
Well, thank you. And perhaps I'm already in agreement with the framework of your concerns. It is my assumption that you in no way wish this to be a vehicle as one part of one state's wishing to have a constitutional convention on the subject. That is not your intent. You don't want the United States Constitutional Convention, and this is a ratification of the call for a convention in which to rewrite the Constitution of the United States. And that's the concern that was voiced here, or at least I've...
That's
you don't want this bill written in such a manner as it would call for that.
No, that's correct. It would be, and I thought I had mentioned earlier that it would be strictly for the sole purpose of the flag desecration,
sure.
not rewriting the entire Constitution.
Other questions of the bill sponsor? Thank you very much. Back on teleconference, I think there were there's several other people here. Mr. Bill Bishop, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please proceed, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us this time to make our testimony. I'd like to first go into the Gallup organization poll from Princeton, New Jersey on the national opinion on the Frank Burning issue as commissioned by the American Legion. The Americans would like to see the American Legion protected by a constitutional amendment. A recent poll conducted by the Gallup organization revealed that 2/3, 66% of the nation said that if they would try to petition asking for a constitutional amendment to make Planned Parenthood illegal. The poll commissioned by the American Legion was conducted by the Gallup organization of Princeton, New Jersey. This was not a poll conducted of American Legion members, but a national random sample of individuals 18 years of age and older living in the continental United States. The survey was conducted by telephone over a 30-day period. Completed during July 1989, sample was controlled for age, sex, and religion to match 1980 U.S. Census data. A three-call bank system was used to guarantee the representative of the sample. The poll showed that, for the most part, Americans were not pleased with the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that ruled that flag burning, even though offensive, was protected under the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment. 6/10 of the respondents interviewed said that they were disagreeing with the Supreme Court ruling. When asked how they felt when they first learned of the Supreme Court ruling concerning burning the American flag, the majority said that they were angry, upset. 48% were disappointed, 24%. Only 9% said that they thought it was a good ruling. And by the support of the flag, almost 2/3, 64% of the respondents said that they think a constitutional amendment should be enacted allowing federal and state governments to make flag burning illegal. Less than 3/10, 27% of the respondents thought that such a constitutional amendment would place their freedom of speech, right, and jeopardy. An effective quote from the is a financial director. But this is a great court decision. That was also proposed by the House Judiciary Committee. And I'm convinced that they did that you won't be enough. I've consulted legal experts from our own counsel, the leading constitutional lawyer, and they agree the only sure way to protect their right is through a constitutional amendment. In closing, I'm still quoting from the Supreme Court Justice, Sparky Gerken. Last year, I marched in the Memorial Day Parade for the first time since I was in the Army. The man carrying the flag was about 71 years old and a World War II vet. He carried that flag tall and did not miss a beat. It ran chills in my back. So let's raise our children to revere and protect their symbol of freedom and opportunity. A Supreme Court decision can be reversed by the manifesting will of the people stirring to action to support their fight and all they stand for. I want to thank you for allowing us to talk about this morning. If there's any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Bishop, thank you very much. Bill Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate you letting us appear at this conference this morning, and my compliments to Senator Zarro and his colleagues for supporting this kind of bill. My colleagues here, Mr. Clinton and Mr. Carver, will summarize my views on this, but I would like to make a quick comment. Not to desecrate the flag, this is really too much to ask for people such as ourselves and American leaders that have dedicated ourselves to this flag for so many years. Some of us are retired from the service and dedicated 20 years plus to the service, all in the name of serving our country, which is supposed to represent the flag. You don't desecrate places of worship. If you desecrate a church, you go to jail. This flag to us is a symbol, the same as a religious symbol is. I do hope that this bill will pass through and the consideration we get into this is really an important factor to those of us that are making the supreme sacrifice. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hogan, thank you. Mr. Mackey, are you scheduled, are you desiring to testify? Mackey, thank you very much. We have somebody online from Washington, D.C., Jim Warner. Mr. Warner, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
We would appreciate your testimony.
Yes, sir, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I oppose this legislation. This is that I want to see the flag burn. Very badly, the flag is burned. I remember being released from 5.5 years prisoner of war in Vietnam. I was flown to the Clark Air Base on the plane. And I remember how I felt when I saw the flag. Even now, I remember that time, tears in my eyes. And I've heard badly when the flag is burned. But there is a higher cause here. I remember once in an interrogation, the officer showed me pictures of a demonstration back home. And it was the same people we saw last month demonstrating against us in the Persian Gulf. The same thing that Drake during one of them burned the flag. And the officer said, see this church, your cause is wrong because Patriot. He met with Aaron Beth, who was the leader of the British Labour Party at the time. And he said to Mr. Beth, where is our democracy different from yours? Aaron Beth said, if you want to know the answer to that, be the funeral oration of Aaron. It's in his History of the Peloponnesian Wars. Well, I've read that. I've read the funeral oration of Pericles. 2,500 years ago, Pericles said what I say today. He said, we in Athens are not afraid of freedom. Freedom source of our strength. And the same is true with us, Mr. Chairman. Freedom is source of our strength. Think back to the photos we saw last week.
Hey, Pericles? Can you hear me, Pericles? I think they got water.
Back to the photographs we saw last week of people in Kuwait City dancing in the street, kissing on the flag. Now ask yourself, Mr. Chairman, were they kissing the flag because they admired the way we repressed these hands, or because of the way we tolerated? Mr. Chairman, the greatest strength that we have is our freedom. The greatest strength, the greatest tool we have is our freedom. It is smarter than our smartest bomb. It's more powerful than our main battle. If we want to keep coals of fire upon the head of Saddam Hussein, all we have to do is operate freedom. Look at the people who demonstrated against Ransom Park. What pathetic band that stood across from the White House and beat drums in Lafayette Square, they're no threat to us, Mr. Chairman. The only way that we can be threatened is if we refuse to tolerate freedom. It hurts. It hurts to see the flag burn. How much more does it hurt the hearts of tyrants to see that we tolerate freedom when they are afraid of it? Mr. Chairman, I urge the committee to associate the bankers.
Mr. Warner, I sure appreciate your remarks. I think that you more eloquently say what, you know, some of us feel on this issue, and you know more than many of us from personal experience what it means and what it means to see flag desecration going on. But you know, at some point I think you're right. We have to look at what the real harm of that is, other than being repulsive and offensive, and that, as you say, I think there is a larger issue that we need to keep sight of, and whether or not we're dealing out of fear or whether or not we're dealing with a real problem, I think is something that we all have to analyze real carefully. Other questions of Mr. Warner? Mr. Warner, thank you very much. Thank you for standing by for us here.
You're quite welcome, sir. Thank you. Good day.
The next person we have to testify is Jamie Ballenbach. Mr. Ballenbach, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Political prisoners again. If we're trying to hold our ideal of freedom, what's the mechanics of the
we had that people would actually be spending time in prison. There's no doubt in our collision of this that the purpose of Burning Heart was to send a message. And if we criminalize any message, we are in fact holding political prisoners. Our purpose, I think, what Jerry wants to protect is grand simple. I don't think that simple is so delicate that a few radicals really threaten it. I think we can uphold our ideal of liberty, and ideal of liberty would apply to our consent much more strongly by tolerating freedom, by tolerating expression, by tolerating even things that are greatly offensive to many of them. I'm sure that, let me give you a slightly different example. The display of display of other lives is deeply offensive to many people in this country. Bring out a Nazi flag that's going to be deeply offensive to people. Bring out a Confederate flag that's going to be deeply offensive to people. But in order to preserve freedom, we have to let the display of these expressions continue. The best part of the example of the Washington Monument. Well, we're not exactly burning the Washington Monument by allowing them to burn the flag. What we're doing is we're talking about a particular symbol in all its forms, the red, white, and blue. Red, white, and blue itself. And whatever reproduction that might come in here, may come in our paper, may come in our font, it's very difficult to figure out exactly what we're talking about. Because we can certainly and correctly prohibit a major criminal act that would desecrate U.S. property, and I think that's appropriate. And somebody wrote down the Gregory Johnson case, I kind of thought it was interesting that Texas is a different tag, and Texas is prosecuted for destruction of government property, because that's what it is, we're kind of a black government building. And burn that. But what we're trying to get at, but that wasn't what they were trying to do. The reason they took the other step, trying to put in prison for burning the flag, was that they were trying to suppress the political belief. And I think that does not speak well of our tolerance and our freedom. I had a question right now.
Do you have a question? Mr. Ballenbach, thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to call Jerry Luckop, if I could, our from our legal division, and maybe you could address specifically the issue of what we're doing here in the way the bill is drafted vis-a-vis a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Luckop. I'm one of your legislative counsel working at legal services of the legislative affairs agencies. Mr. Chairman, this amendment, this joint resolution proposes, one, that Congress enact an amendment to the Constitution and submit it to the states for ratification concerning the flag, and two, that if the Congress chooses not to do that, that they call a convention once two-thirds of the states have submitted similar resolutions as this to the Congress. There is some question as to whether or not if Congress were to call a convention, whether it could be limited to one specific purpose or not. The language of the Constitution seems to imply that Congress would have that authority. Nobody knows because we haven't had one. We've never had one at all. There is also a question presented as to whether or not this as to how long this memorial, this resolution, this application by the state of Alaska would last. It would be my opinion that this application would last forever until it is reconsidered or recalled or repealed or a different resolution is enacted by this legislature. There is some authority for the proposition that a application for a constitutional convention or for a constitutional amendment must be considered in a specific period of time, that it must be considered under the circumstances, under the mores of the day, and that at times, in considering the ratification of a constitutional amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that, or courts have held, that 12 and a half years after the initial after Congress initially submitted the amendment to the states for ratification, that process was over at that time, that was too long a period. That's why Congress now, when they submit amendments to the states, like with the ERA amendment that was submitted several years back, there was a time limit the states had to act within to consider that. If there's a concern on behalf of the committee that they would not want this call for a constitutional convention on a specific issue to be out there forever, then the resolution could be worded in a way that the constitutional convention must be called within 5 years of this date. If there are further questions, I could address those.
Well, just to clarify, you kind of lost me there at the end. Are you saying that there is a direct possibility that this resolution would be viewed first as a petition as part of the second portion of the amendment to the Constitution process, calling for a constitutional convention? I mean, you mentioned several things, but let's start with the first thing there.
Mr. Chairman, it is our opinion that this would be considered a call for a constitutional convention for a specific purpose. The Constitution merely requires that upon the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, that the Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments. This, on lines 26 to 29 on page 2 of the bill, it is resolved by the Alaska State Legislature that Congress is requested to call a convention for the sole and exclusive purpose of proposing and submitting to the states an amendment to the Constitution that meets the clear language of the federal Constitution. That could be cleared up to say to call a convention under Article 5 of the United States Constitution. We wanted to clarify that a little more, but it appears to me that this is a call, one, for the Congress to enact a constitutional amendment and submit it to the states for ratification, or two, if Congress chooses not to do this, that upon when Congress receives resolutions similar to this or identical to this from two-thirds of the states, that the Congress will then call a constitutional convention for the purpose stated in the resolution.
Let me ask you a question. Have you followed this bill through the Senate? Have you been the bill drafter who followed the course of this through committees?
Yes.
Was this bill discussed in Judiciary Committee?
I haven't had any discussion on the bill.
Tom,
I haven't testified.
Did this bill go through Judiciary Committee? Was this question raised? You know, this is a very serious question, and I'm just amazed that people are not paying close attention to this. And this goes far beyond flag burning issue, which is a whole problem in itself, I think. Constitution. Questions? Senator Kutula.
Just that you have exploited the question, it goes to two things. One, I think Senator Zarf testify that this was something he wasn't wishing to have happen in a constitutional call. We need Senator Zarf back up on that question. I'm pretty certain that he doesn't expect this to incorporate a call for a constitutional convention in any way. I'm not certain, but I would believe there should be more artful drafting to make sure that is in any way implied. I may be wrong, but I think he ought to come back up on that question and on the answers. But two, and this is just an observation, every once in a while we're held a bit incredulous at the fact that key and important committees that have absolute responsibility and still send the responsibility back up to the final committee, whatever that committee might be, whether it was finance at this time or judiciary at another time, you still make the decision somehow or other on the whole broad gamut, in this case legal, constitutional issues. And it's interesting to me, the observation that I just reported, it happens all the time in finance.
Other questions? Senator Adams?
Yes. Since it's on page number 2, lines 21 through 30th, and whether the alternatives is a call of a convention, and in your statement you have stated there is no format for a convention. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Adams.
And do you believe that perhaps that Congress at this time is still trying to get a format going, perhaps on a balanced federal budget?
There are, I believe that there are many constitutional conventions, considerations for constitutional amendments or constitutional conventions being considered at any time.
Since the sponsor of the legislation testified that he was not in favor of a convention, is it a possibility that you can redraft this legislation and put it in a non-binding rewrite?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, from my discussions with the sponsor and from hearing his testimony today, the sponsor seemed to say he did not support a constitutional convention that could rewrite the entire Constitution. From my discussions with the sponsor, his view is, as presented in the bill, that he supports a constitutional convention for the sole and specific purpose of proposing an amendment to the Constitution.
Of course, we don't have control over that, right? It wasn't your testimony that the Congress decides the topics to be considered in the Constitutional Convention?
Congress, Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that Congress could call a convention for a purpose other than what the states have requested the convention for. The request for a convention by two-thirds of the states must be similar in purpose. There is some question as to whether it obviously would be rather absurd to think that the Alaska State Legislature to pass this resolution, and the state of Arizona, the legislature of the state of Arizona, would pass a resolution concerning a balanced federal budget, that those would be similar calls for a constitutional convention. If the legislature of state of Alaska were to ask for a constitutional convention without specifying a purpose or requesting that it only be convened for a particular purpose, then that constitutional convention could possibly match up with others that it was not directly contradictory with. I hope I've addressed some of the questions there. There is always the opportunity to change this bill and to remove the request for a constitutional convention. There is also the opportunity to submit a resolution where the Alaska State Legislature would say that it supports a Congress passing an amendment to the Constitution, not requesting a constitutional convention. There's also the opportunity to submit a resolution that says that we think it would be nice to have this, but we aren't requesting Congress to do anything, whether to pass an amendment themselves or to call a convention for the purposes of proposing an amendment to the Constitution.
Other questions? Bill Drafter? I have not been shy about expressing my real concerns for this bill and for this action, and I've been trying to be fair as possible to give this bill a hearing against all my better judgments, and I do see it. I take it extremely personal in the sense that while I fly a flag from my house every day and I am as dismayed with flag burners as anybody, this does represent to me something that's taking a freedom away from me and taking a basic freedom away. And I don't read the Constitution or its amendments in this light. We have had one similar constitutional amendment that took away a freedom, and that was, of course, prohibition, and we repealed that amendment. If you look through the Constitution and its amendments, all the rest of them expand basic freedoms or are technical in nature. And this is a very departure from that, where we're really limiting people's freedom of speech and not because we're being overrun by flag burners. And it is an emotional issue, it's a symbolic issue that we all feel, but I'm just dismayed that we're calling for major changes to our basic constitution. However, I, in deference to the bill sponsor and I'm sure other members, I think we need to pursue this bill as best we can. It would be my hope, though, that we could take this bill back and rework it with the bill sponsor to try to alleviate some of these even graver concerns, I think, regarding constitutional conventions. And I don't know if others on the committee share that concern or not. Senator Adams?
I just wanted to ask a policy question. It's not only with this piece of legislation that even the sponsor didn't want to call for the convention, that this bill should be reworked in judiciaries, and there are other bills that will be coming up to finance, and I can say, like Senate Bill 109, civil liabilities for construction. It's unconstitutional, and yet it'll come out of judiciary.
what's going to be the policy on some of these particular questions when they come up here. Are we going to rewrite these bills in committee, which is fine with me, but...
Well, we have two operating maxims on that. One is we make good bills better, but the other one is you don't make a bad bill better. And I don't, and I'm wrestling with that in my mind, and I don't know what the answer is between those two rules.
Certainly is we don't do anything with bad bills.
Senator Kutula.
It falls on finance historically, and many years I've been off finance, on and off. It falls on finance historically to have the responsibility to write, rewrite, make bills correct for once they're sent out to other committees, or not to act on the bill as they see fit by majority. My experiences are when you've got something that the whole committee does not have time, that each one of us takes up a certain portion as a subcommittee and gets a certain number of these bills that are not necessarily financial or primary financial, but are in fact assigned to us for varying reasons. In fact, they may have modest financial consequences. And the subcommittee does its best with legal counsel and others to whomever, economists and so on, to come back to the committee within some period of time with suggested amendments and a rewrite, whatever is required, or maybe a report on the legislation. Sending it back to the other committee is the other way, but it always kind of looks somewhat arrogant to the other committee, even though they do argue with us when we get substantive change. But this is just another example of the fact that the buck stops here, because a big part of the legislature is budget. And I think it's kind of incumbent on us to make do with what we can in a manner, I think, that we have historically, and that is assigned specific bills and specific responsibilities that are not primarily financial in nature to subcommittees to work on and bring back for us as they can, and as they have the time. Hopefully, no one or two members would be assigned too much of the subcommittee work to go around the table. That's the thought I have on it, rather than sitting back committee.
Well, I share that feeling, too, and direct answer to Senator Adams, I think that we don't want to get in a position of offending other committees that they feel that they've done their work, and I think the procedure on that note will be we will do the best we can utilizing those members that have particular concerns on issues, recognizing the fairness that I don't think that as a policy we're going to just send bills to their grave at the hands of individual finance members. If there are other people that want to see those things for their merits or demerits headed for the floor. On this particular bill, it would be my suggestion that we work on this bill in committee, and I will be working with Senator Zaroff and Senator Adams and anyone else that has ideas, and we do have two amendments that we will try to address also in trying to clear up some of the objections to this bill. If there's no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill we'll take up is another old friend here, Senate Bill 96. I don't know if there's anybody from Senator Frank's office here. Is there anybody from Senator Frank's office?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. You want to come forward? We did have two questions that arose last time. I don't believe we're on teleconference on this bill anymore. One of the questions that arose, Senator Adams. No, you, this is your bill.
I know.
One of the questions that we did try to deal with was the question of state employees or municipal employees and their $150 a day compensation versus their taking of leave. We did work with the bill sponsor on language that was acceptable, at least as far as I know, to him regarding that one issue. That is contained in a, and again, this is just a proposed CS on this one issue, found on line 7 and 8, where the sentence was added, a member who is an employee of the state or a local government is entitled to the $150 a day compensation only for a day on which the member takes annual leave or leave without pay from the state or local government position. And that put it into a choice situation so that the person was not being paid for that day and received, or wasn't being, he was either forced to take leave and get the $150 or not get the $150 and remain on the payroll. Maybe we could hear from the bill sponsor on that particular amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I worked with a member of your staff on the wording of the change, and Senator Frank is in agreement with the committee substitute.
Questions on that, Senator Duncan?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm not sure I understand the rationale for that and where that concern was brought up. It seems to me that you're penalizing individuals who may want to serve on boards or commissions who are public employees. You're asking them to do something that other employees in the private sector may not be asked to do. I mean, private sector employers may not require that that individual take annual leave or give up a day of pay in order to serve on a board or commission. I guess I'm concerned that this is not equal treatment among all citizens of the state, that you're discouraging, this will discourage public employees from wanting to serve on boards and commissions if they're required to either, one, give up a day of pay, secondly, take a day of annual leave, or the third option is get $150 a day compensation, which probably, in some cases, may not even be. I guess this is for compensation and. I guess I'm just concerned about that differentiation between public sector employers and private sector employees. I don't know why we would do that, and I'm going to have a hard time supporting the legislation with that in it.
Other questions? Senator Schultz and then Senator Adams.
Yeah. Well, my original thought was to exempt the people from the public employees and not make them eligible for the $150 at all. And then it's a policy decision as far as the legislature is concerned as to whether or not you want to allow public employees to sit on boards and commissions and continue to pay them wages. I don't know what the policy would be or is of the private sector. However, I would think that the private sector is certainly not going to pay for people to be on boards and commissions if they're not there. I can't imagine that. Unless it's some large company, an oil company or something, maybe something like that, but the private sector, I just can't imagine someone allowing an employee sitting on a commission that meets frequently. Can't even imagine having them as an employee very long.
Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, I have passed out a letter that I've written to the Honorable Governor there. It's dated March 4th, and I think this is a policy call that we need to look at, and I think that the administration needs to be involved in. There is presently 129 boards, of which 108 receives no salary. And I think this, if you want to serve on some of these boards, you should do it on a volunteer basis with the exception of per diem and travel. And so I'm asking that perhaps we need to look at this in a subcommittee to work on policy calls. You start with this one. What's the difference between the Board of Education? They get zero. What about the Board of Regents with the university system? Don't they do more work than the local boundary commission? And it's a value call there that I think we need to make.
There's vast differences, all right, Mr. Chairman, too. 400 for one, 150 for another. Them for another. There are many boards that ought to be purely public in interest. I have no doubt about that. You contribute a few days a year, you're not called upon often. It's a distinct contribution. Everybody ought to make the government service at one time or another if they have any interest at all. Democratic responsibility. But then there's major service boards, and they are vastly different in emoluments. And he makes a good point.
Senator Hewley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, presently on all these boards, are they compensated if they're a state employee? I'm sure there's got to be some state employees on there. Are they compensated?
I'd ask Senator Duncan.
What's the question?
On state employees.
Are they compensated on these other boards with $150?
They double dip.
Senator Duncan.
I have no idea. I don't know without looking at it. I wouldn't call it double dipping. I think that probably people from a number of businesses and corporations around the state. I can think of native corporations and others who probably serve on boards and commissions who don't give up salary when they're serving on the boards and commissions and get per diem. I didn't mean to point, but that's an example. You asked for an example. I think also there's a problem here that in many collective bargaining agreements,
with school districts and perhaps even with municipalities, teachers, for example, who are appointed to certain boards or commissions and may have their collective bargaining agreements, that they can serve on those type of things, have release time that does not require them to give up annual leave or pay, and would allow them to serve and still receive the per diem and the compensation that would go along with that service. So I think we're really getting into an area that we don't know the total impact on, and this type of amendment needs to be looked at very carefully before we move ahead. I think it's not right to try to single out one class of employee in the state to say that they have to serve on a board or commission in a different stature than other folks do.
Senator Adams, to Senator Adams, in your letter, my understanding is that you are asking the governor to do a task force to look into compensation for all boards and commissions.
That's
is that
correct,
your intent?
To see some that could be eliminated or joined together. Just a policy call on some of these things. Somebody mentioned it was a double dipping as a state employee as far as commission. Perhaps what we could do is take the example, and we have a prime example of perhaps the guy yesterday that was on the Human Rights Commission that worked for DOT. Let's just use that as him to see if he got a meet and fee or anything like that.
Well, he doesn't even deserve to be employed.
Senator Ewing, and then...
Senator Adams makes a good point. You know, I'm not laying out this bill, but I mean, it seems like, we've got all these commissions that there should be a policy call. We shouldn't be just putting in lines, a line stating that this is going to be such and such with this boundary commission, not even knowing what all these other commission members do. So we've got limited knowledge on it. I think you've got to start looking at it from a policy standpoint, how you're going to try to approach all the commissions without just singling out and putting a line in here stating such and such.
Well, I think Senator Adams' suggestion is a good one. One alternative that we might do, of course, is if directed by the committee, the Finance Committee could write a similar letter suggesting this occur and also addressing the question of equity for state employees who serve on boards or commissions. Senator Hoffman, were you seeking for?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is not the only piece of legislation that is in the hopper for looking at compensation for board members. The President of the Senate, Dick Eliason, has a bill in the hopper to address compensation for the board's of Fish and Game. And I guess I'm unsure as to what we're doing here, whether we're going to rely upon the governor to take the initiative. And we put on hold all the bills, including Senator Eliason's bill, regarding compensation, or do we go ahead, as you suggest, and take a look at what the policy issues are regarding compensation for boards and commissions? It would seem that since we do have specific senators and possibly representatives introducing legislation to address individual areas of interest that they have, that we may want to take a broad look at what's happening with these salaries.
I think the point is a good one. In fact, in looking through Senator Adams' list, I saw a couple of boards and commissions there that I've known people who, like Workman's Comp Board, for example, and the Labor Relations Board, where people have worked literally 3 to 5 days each month for no extra compensation other than their expenses, and clearly we do risk running another set of inequalities in any action we may take at this time. Other comments on the part of the committee? I'm not Senator Schultz.
Okay, just a question. Has it always been a policy? I get obviously it has. And what's the rationale for having state employees on boards and commissions when they, in fact, sit on other policy-making committees or boards within departments? I mean, you'll have a group of them that get together that set policy sometimes for the very reason that a board or a commission is established. I mean, is it just simply a discrimination thing?
Senator Duncan. Well, Mr. Chairman, because you become a state employee doesn't mean you are not a citizen of the state of Alaska, just like everyone else is. So you still retain citizenship when you become a state employee. You have the same rights as other individuals and the same interests as other individuals. For example, you may work in the Department of Transportation as a state employee, but have a great interest in public broadcasting. and may be appointed to serve on the Alaska Public Broadcasting Board or Commission. Doesn't mean that you should not be allowed to do that.
Would it be appropriate to make a policy or anything else that says, in fact, that if you're with Fishing Game, that you do not sit on commissions or boards that have something to do with Fishing Game? Maybe they're interested in child care or whatever. I have no problem with that. But what I'm saying is, oftentimes that the people that are sitting on these boards and commissions that are public employees may in fact be perpetuating their own agenda, their own cause.
Mr. Chairman, we may even by statute require that certain employees of the Department of Fish and Game serve on certain boards and commissions relating to Fish and Game, because they do have an expertise also. So I don't think we can make an across-the-board statement that just because you work in the department means you shouldn't serve on any board or commission that has any relationship to that department. We may by statute require some of that already. So the answer to your question is, I don't think there's any broad brush answer to this. I think you've got to be very careful that you don't cause some difficulties as you try to discriminate against certain employees and certain people of the state. I think everybody has kind of like has the same rights, and just because they have to work in the state doesn't mean those rights should be diminished.
I guess my thing is that I believe that the state employees have a better opportunity and better access to boards and commissions than people in the general public. So I think it's a reverse discrimination thing. I think it's the private sector and the public people that are being excluded at the expense maybe of the public
servants.
Well, I think one whole thing ought to be looked at. I don't think there's much doubt whatsoever. But I'm not sure, to slightly argue the case, that you don't have to have something like an alternate minimum income tax. If you get a certain total level out of the income of the state, maybe at that stage the rest ought to be contributed time, really. Get people that are extremely well paid and then still get the other emoluments, and there may not be a fairness vis-a-vis the private sector, but still I think people at the commissioner level and director level, 26s and so on, maybe they ought to give a little bit of time. Years ago, the policeman's wife answered the phone in the rural areas for the Public Safety Commission, and they did it for years and years and years, and then telephoned their husbands who were out there on the road someplace checking in. It was just the thing that was done because we didn't have money. Today, it seems to me that some of these upper echelon people, it goes with the job, at least the appointed and that group.
Senator, I don't disagree with you, Senator. I don't think I was arguing that the commissioner transportation, for example, should get $150 a day extra for serving on some.
No, I don't think you were.
But I was arguing about the range 12 or 14 down in the department. Mm-hmm. This is a very broad brush amendment and a very broad brush approach that Schultz is talking about that would impact everyone.
But that was all I was thinking about. There is a level of employee that you shouldn't impose on. I agree with you.
Senator Hall.
Well, I guess I do have similar concerns that Senator Schultz has, being a public servant. And we're talking about public servants that are hired to provide service to the people of the state of Alaska or to local governments. And I did participate in some of the other duties that weren't assigned to me as city manager. And the question that comes to mind is, does that person, when he's gone, is he replaced, and are those services being performed by someone else because they're necessary, or aren't they? You know, and is it better for the public sector to go ahead and have that person pay his normal salary and not get compensated while he's doing the other functions? You know, and I think that's those type of issues have to be looked at when the decision is made.
Other questions or comments? Senator Adams.
Yes. Even though I have written a letter to Hickel, I would like that this particular committee as a whole continue and follow up with the letter, and that this bill be put into a subcommittee until we have maybe perhaps a reply back from the governor or from his designee, Don Tanner, who does boards and commissions, so that perhaps that we can work on this piece of legislation. A fair piece of legislation.
Is there any objections to the suggestion by Senator Adams that the committee would follow up with a committee letter similar to Senator Adams, but and also I would assume addressing the question of looking at state employee participation in boards and commissions and their compensation.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with that. In fact, one of the problems I think is that we do all this stuff very piecemeal. We have a bill that passes and it's got a specific little thing in there for that group of people. And if you're going to look at it, it has to be looked at from a policy standpoint. It should be a policy that applies to every board and commission, it seems like.
That would be the thrust of the recommendation. Senator Duncan.
I got to say that I don't have a problem with that. I got to say I have very little confidence that what we'll get back from, and I say this not disrespect, very little confidence that what we'll get back from the third floor will make a whole lot of sense on a broad policy issue as far as how this should be addressed. I would have more confidence, quite honestly, if we would address a letter or request to our legislative audit staff to go in and review boards and commissions and the present structure and what type of policy might be adopted to ensure equity between payment levels for compensation, and also to address, to make recommendations to address this question of public employees, which is just not state. It includes local governments, school district employees, et cetera, public employees, and how their status should be as they serve on boards and commissions. I'd have more confidence if we'd address it to that body than to the third board. I don't know who they'll assign to this up there. I don't know who they've got that's got that institutional knowledge and background to do this. And so I guess I'm thinking maybe we should, in the legislature, should take the bull by the horn and ask our people to review that.
I don't think it may make interesting reading, at least to hear from them. I don't see a problem in doing both things. Several people on this committee serve on LBNA, and maybe someone could make that request for the audit through the chairman Larson to do that, and we could take this course also. I don't see them as necessarily contradictory, or they may result in contradictory information, but useful to us.
Everybody would like to see a solution, Mr. Chairman, and it's a pretty broad policy question. I think you're right. It's appropriate that a letter be addressed and contact made with budget and audit, and then go through the system if necessary. But I think that will be a good and well done and informative and pretty fair analysis for our decision. Also, I do agree with you, since I hear rumors administration is going to get into this whole field anyway, and it's a rumor, but I've heard it, perhaps when we got some of this material Senator Adams has attached here. I just left them on my desk, kept looking at them, and not doing anything but still worrying them, that we ought to send the administration and ask them what their position, what they're doing about it, and what their recommendation may be. That would be a good, at least, addendum type letter. I agree with your analysis here.
Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to pursuing that course of action?
Take the bull by the horns.
If not, we'll follow up on that, and I assume that individual members or one member will at least contact and make the official request to LBNA, and we'll hold this bill pending that analysis.
Sure, I'm not interested in making that request as an individual. I think, quite honestly, if this is a committee, if we're commissioning a right letter to the governor, this same type of letter should go to the LBNA committee.
I'm not sure. I didn't mean that we couldn't do it. My understanding of the rules, I could be wrong, is that individual members make the request. I don't know if committees have that standing or not. I'll sure pursue it with Representative Larson.
I think
you can request it. I don't know.
Let me pursue it with Representative Larson.
But anyway, it goes through the process.
We will do it as a committee if we can. If we can't, I'll get back to those of you on LBNA.
I've only seen individuals.
Yeah, that's my experience. If not, we will...
I'd like to see them say no if they actually have to come to us for the budget.
We'll just keep this bill on hand pending that investigation. The next bill before us is, again,